BBC News with Sue Montgomery. NATO's Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg has acknowledged that alliance members have enough air defence systems to allow a lot more help to be sent to Ukraine as it faces increased Russian bombardment. On Wednesday morning, an attack in the northern city of Chernihiv killed at least 17 people. James Waterhouse reports.
In Chernihiv, it was a morning when bus passengers had to dive for cover after two missiles hit the centre of the city. What followed was the haunting sound of a third. Rescue teams are still going through their well-rehearsed routine of trying to find anyone alive under the rubble. The number of dead and injured could still rise. President Zelensky has blamed his Western allies for not providing sufficient air defences to prevent this attack from happening.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the visiting British and German foreign ministers his country will do whatever is needed to defend itself. David Cameron and Annalena Baerbock urged restraint after the huge missile and drone attack by Iran against Israel over the weekend. Lord Cameron said it was clear that Israel had made a decision to retaliate, but hoped it would be limited. Later, Mr. Netanyahu thanked both ministers for their support, but appeared less keen on taking their advice.
They also have all kinds of suggestions and advice. I appreciate it, but I want to make it clear. We will make our own decisions, and the State of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself.
President Biden has said there will be no trade war with Beijing, despite making it clear he wants a big increase in tariffs on imports of Chinese steel and aluminium. He's expected to tell steelworkers' unions in Pennsylvania that he wants tariffs tripled. Jonathan Josephs reports.
President Biden says having a viable steel and aluminium industry is crucial, and cheap Chinese products are a threat to its existence, as well as being more polluting. Further tariffs could be imposed because of an investigation into supposedly unfair Chinese practices in the shipbuilding, maritime and logistics sectors. This is an effort to look tough on trade in the presidential election campaign against Donald Trump, who has also called for more tariffs on Chinese products. Beijing has repeatedly voiced objections to tariffs, saying they harm the global economy.
The embattled airplane manufacturer Boeing is under scrutiny at the US Senate, where back-to-back hearings are taking place into allegations of safety failures. The Commerce Committee is hearing from an expert panel that strongly criticised the safety culture at the company. A separate session features a Boeing whistleblower who claims the company cut corners in the manufacture of its 787 Dreamliner. Boeing has defended the plane. BBC News. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has addressed a conference of hard-right politicians in Brussels, charging that freedom in Europe is in danger. He criticised an attempt by local mayor on Tuesday to shut down the gathering. A Belgian judge overturned the decision, ruling that a ban would violate the right to peaceful assembly. A new study has calculated that the effects of climate change will reduce annual global GDP by nearly a fifth by the middle of the century. The figure is the equivalent of $38 trillion a year. Scientists in Germany warn that the economic damage will be felt no matter how aggressively carbon emissions are cut, but said tackling global warming remains vital to prevent the cost rising further. The leader of a Nigerian separatist movement has appeared in the High Court in the capital Abuja. Nnamdi Kanu, who leads the banned Indigenous People of Biafra movement, faces several charges, which he denies. Chris Awoko reports.
Nnamdi Kanu appeared in court for a second time this year since the Supreme Court quashed his bid to overturn the trial. His legal team accused Nigeria Secret Police of continuing to block access to their client. They have asked the court to move him from the custody of the Department of State Service to the regular prison detention. Mr. Kanu, who has British as well as Nigerian citizenship, was controversially taken from Kenya by Nigerian agents in 2021 after fleeing while on bail. The trial has been adjourned to May.
Sales of Chinese beer in South Korea plunged by more than 60% in the first 3 months of the year after an online video showed a man urinating into a tank at a Qingdao brewery. Qingdao said it sealed off that batch from all other production, but its sales have yet to recover. BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
Hello, and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Nate Carlin. Today, our guest is Wendy Villa. She is the co-founder and president of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, a nonprofit that works on the international nature of far-right extremism and how those movements affect democracies. She is here today to discuss Project 2025, a right-wing document that lays out the far-right's game plan if they win the United States presidency. Wendy, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the thousand-mile view. What is Project 2025?
Project 2025 is a 950-page plan issued by the Heritage Foundation on what should happen in the first 180 days of the next conservative president's administration. Heritage has been putting out these sort of mandate for leadership plans for years, but in the last few years, they have moved from being described as a Reagan Republican conservative outfit to what we would consider to be a far right think tank at this point.
Yeah, can you chase that evolution for a little bit? Because this is something that the Heritage Foundation kind of famously has been doing for 30 plus years now. What's different this time, I guess?
Well, I think that what's different this time is that you see some recommendations that you would never have seen before, primarily because we as a society have crossed that line that used to divide what you would never hear in sort of polite company or in political debates. We've crossed the line into hearing things that you just would not expect, but it has become commonplace. So in other words, things like associating transgender people with pedophilia and pornography, or saying something like critical race theory is a noxious idea, things like that, sort of blatantly anti-LGBTQ, anti-woman, anti-Black, people of color. These are the issues that are very prominent in Project 2025.
And is that likely to matter to the next Republican administration? How influential have these been in the past?
Well, I think that you mean these ideas of restricting the rights for those communities.
Well, that's a good point too, but no, I was thinking more just along the lines of how influential is the Heritage Foundation?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, well, I would say that the Heritage Foundation is extremely influential at this point. Their influence increased, I would say, in 2016 and then again in 2020, because what happened was Donald Trump was running. He crossed those lines and he needed the evangelical vote, right? He needed the sort of the Christian conservatives to get on board, which there was some hesitancy in the beginning for that to happen. But then he made assurances to all of these groups like Leo Leonard and Heritage Foundation and Alliance Defending Freedom. He made assurances to them and the Federalist Society that he would give them the judges, that he would make these policy changes, and they got on board and have grown in power ever since.
And can you talk a little bit about the work your organization does on Project 2025? I think the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism has sort of an interesting ongoing investigation there. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, well, our organization is focused on the growth and spread of far-right extremism, both here in the United States and across the globe. We particularly focus on the export of far-right extremism from America to other countries, because it is true that some of these ideas originate in America. Certainly the funding does. And what we have seen in the last couple of years in particular is a really big push to get into other countries, make allies with in places like Hungary or Brazil with Bolsonaro or Meloni in Italy, Le Pen in France. So these far-right actors, and especially the think tanks, are all working together in a sense. They are networking and collaborating. And so what we do is we expose that. We try to get people to understand how the dots are connected. We expose how it is not a conservative agenda, which at this point, I think that the idea of far right and conservative is being conflated, but it's not a conservative agenda. It is a far right, right restricting agenda. And that's what we do. We expose that and try to stop it. Now on Project 2025, they have done us the favor of finally putting all of their ideas on paper. And the biggest thing that we as a public can do is believe them when they say this is what they want. But we we constantly are educating and raising awareness about who is behind Project 2025, what are the things that they're doing on a weekly basis, as opposed to just what's in this carefully curated document, and what they're doing at the local and state level, as well as at the national level.
Yeah, it seems like Project 2025, I mean, it starts with this huge document that's so many hundred pages. But it also has these interesting things around training and lists of personnel and sort of how staffing, advice on how staffing should go in the future. Can you talk a little bit about that and what else is going on here?
Yeah, so you may be aware that the far right in the United States believes that the government has been overtaken by wokeism. Well, wokeism, for those who may not know, it used to be a good term, meaning that people were aware of what's going on in our country, aware of racial divides, gender divides. But now it is used as a pejorative to indicate that people who are woke are irrational. And so they believe that our government and the civil service has been taken over by wokeism. And had that not happened, then Trump would have been able to implement a lot more of the policies that he wanted to implement that he had promised these groups. So the idea is he comes in, the next conservative president, and that's one thing I want to make clear, is that this isn't just about Trump. It, regardless of who wins the election in November, Project 2025 and all of its aspects do not go away. This is a plan. This is a vision that is already being implemented at the local, state, and national level, and in the courts, and it will continue to be pursued regardless of who wins. But just for the sake of discussion, if Trump wins, then the idea would be that he would remove all the career civil servants from the government and replace them with people who they would say, or he would say, are neutral, fair, but in fact, a part of Project 2025 is recruiting and training these potential appointees.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that? Looking at the document, for me, it reminded me a lot of sort of Red Scare, Lavender Scare language of, like, it's time to root out the enemy within. And that seems like an interesting turn in right-wing thought.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. They, you know, the folks behind Project 2025 talk a lot about Chinese communism. They talk about how it's a conspiracy, the deep state, you know, that's obviously a conspiracy theory. And it is about rooting out these people in every aspect. Like, it's going to, you root them out within the government, find the illegal immigrants, as they describe them. Find the people who are grooming your children in schools. It's about targeting and removing different communities.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT. Today, we're with Wendy Vaya from Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, discussing Project 2025, a plan for the next Republican presidency. If you have any questions about rising extremism in right-wing policymaking, please give us a call at 608-256-2001. Yeah, so let's drill down a little bit into what this would look like if it succeeds. Like let's say the next Republican president follows this plan to a T. What would happen at, say, the Department of Justice? I think that's the big one, or the FBI, sort of.
Yeah. So what this plan will do, it aggrandizes the executive branch, and it would take every power that isn't specifically relegated to another branch and put it squarely within the executive branch. And because what we're dealing with when it comes to things like rulemaking or appointments or managing some of the departments, these are not laws, they're norms. It's what's always been done, it's what's accepted. And it's always been accepted that the president does not interfere with the DOJ and investigations. It's, you know, because it is meant that our justice system is meant to be not political in the least. Now, of course, we all know that's not true, but what would happen is that it would specifically become political. And the recommendation for the very first day is for the president to take a look at all the ongoing cases and litigation out of the DOJ and decide if any will continue and which, if any, are in conflict with his agenda. And so that would be the first thing. So any kind of investigation that the DOJ was doing into January 6th, for example, or into Trump's past behavior, or into a Steve Bannon, you know, all these people who have been prosecuted in Trump's orbit, would, you know, those cases would be reviewed and it would be decided whether or not they would continue. The FBI would be weaponized I'm trying to think of words that explain the seriousness of it. The FBI would be weaponized to investigate political enemies, things that you only see in authoritarian countries. And this is the recommendation.
There also seems to be a deep belief, kind of what we were alluding to before, that there are lots of FBI agents that have a far left ideology, and they should be sort of rooted out and fired.
Yes, and that's part of that. The government is woke, and it's been, and that the government needs to be rescued from the radical far left, because in our federal government, or in state and local governments, you have initiatives like affirmative action. You do have DEI initiatives, you have racial equity programs, you have LGBTQ equity programs, all of these things that the Project 2025 supporters believe are wrong, and that because these people have been trained in these issues, that they've been inculcated in this, and that therefore, you know, they can't be saved, so then we need to get rid of them.
And I guess, is that authoritarian? Is that a fair word to use in this situation, or does it not quite rise to that level?
Oh, no, I would definitely use it in this situation. This entire plan is a blueprint for authoritarianism because there's some hallmarks of authoritarianism. One is concentrating all the power in the executive branch, right? Another hallmark is politicizing independent institutions like the FBI or the DOJ. Another is weakening checks and balances between the various branches. The quashing criticism and dissent, making it where people are either afraid or at risk of some kind of legal intervention if they are vocal, restricting the rights of specific communities, and in Project 2025, as I mentioned, women, LGBTQ people, people of color are very much going to see their rights restricted and rolled back. And then you have reducing faith in elections or corrupting elections. And so, you know, half the country at this, not quite half, I think about 40% of Republicans in this country do not believe that Biden is the legitimate president. So we've already done that. And then finally, there's stoking violence, which, you know, we all know about the violence that has been associated with these initiatives and are very definitely going to continue.
All right. Well, we have a caller, Jim, who has a question about libertarianism. Go ahead, Jim.
I'm just wondering if you consider libertarianism to be right wing.
Okay. I would not consider libertarianism itself to be right wing. I think that there are right wing or more conservative aspects of libertarianism, depending on, you know, the individual.
Well, you know, when you think about it, I don't know if you know or are familiar with Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, but she covers the whole Koch issue from the very beginning. And the Kochs were responsible for, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, ALEC, et cetera, et cetera, and the Tea Party. I mean, that whole, and they regard themselves as being very libertarian. Well, what they're talking about doing anyway is taking over the country by the trillionaires and the billionaires. And
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned, that's pretty right wing.
Well, it is, but I think that I totally agree with you. And I do think that, I mean, and you bring up a good point in that this project, this movement is funded by, you know, a handful, maybe two handfuls of billionaires, right? But I think that what some of these folks do is that they hide behind more acceptable labels or what they perceive to be more acceptable, like being a libertarian, when in fact they're far right, but they, you know, fudge what they say, or some of these groups say that they are in pursuit of family and rights for everybody, but what they really mean is no, LGBTQ people can't have kids, and so it's about masking who they are. So I agree with you.
The only thing, I mean, I don't have any trouble with what you're doing. It's that, I mean, the John Birch Society was founded by the Koch's father, who made his money drilling oil wells in Russia.
That's right.
And that's where the big guns are. And if you can't do much with the clogged pipe of Congress, as the way it sits now, you're going to have to go after those guys. You're going to have as much power as they do in order to get much done. I mean, there's still some reason for hope out there. I mean, Biden's not doing too bad of a job, but it could be a lot better than what it is. And, I mean, all these human rights, I mean, those guys, the whole Koch operation, they don't think anything about human rights at all. I mean, they're racist. They're just got awful things, you know.
I guess we lost you.
Sorry, Jim. I think you're cutting out a little bit there, buddy.
Oh, okay. You're familiar with this ALEC operation, American Legislative Exchange Council?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's how they organize all of this stuff. They get the Republican legislators to come to these meetings once a year, and where all the lobbyists are, and they're handed the ALEC agenda, and they have to run this stuff through their state legislatures, and it's all over the country, including Wisconsin.
All right, Jim, thanks for your question. Yeah, I think that is an interesting point about the network that's at play here. It's not just Heritage Foundation. It's all these other linked ideas that are playing into this. I guess, do you want to add a comment, Wendy?
I was just going to say that Jim is right about ALEC and how and all these groups are connected. They are funded by the billionaires and people who want to preserve rights, the rights preserving movements. Civil society does need to have as many resources as the right does, but we don't. And that is a fact of the matter. And it is one of the biggest factors in the progress that the far right extremist movement have made in this country. And I also want to emphasize another thing he said is that we're talking about Project 2025 and what's going to be done at the federal level, but we cannot forget that many, many aspects of this are occurring or being codified in states across our nation, and that these groups are behind initiatives like getting rid, about school board elections, not allowing, it seems insignificant maybe to the Koch brothers, but you start at the bottom and you get rid of drag shows, you ban books, ban mifepristone, and you start to talk about no contraception. All of these things seem disconnected, but they are all very connected and part of the plan that works from the ground up and the top down.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is A Public Affair on WORT. Today, our guest is Wendy Vaya. She is discussing the likely policies from the next Republican administration and how they relate to new forms of the conservative movement. If you have questions or concerns about Democratic backsliding in the U.S. or globally, go ahead and give us a call at 608-256-2001. Yeah, I did want to ask the question of why... I think there was a promise that maybe 20 years ago, that rising globalism, increased communications technologies, that would create a sort of a global community. And we see that there's a very successful global community of right-wing policymaking and ideology, and less so other spaces. Would you say that's true, or am I misrepresenting it?
No, I would say that's true.
So why did that occur? And yeah.
Well, it goes, it's something, it's just that idea is always a topic of discussion. How can civil society and groups across the globe who want to preserve and expand rights to be inclusive, to have multicultural and inclusive democracies, how is it that so many times they're getting pushed back by the far right? And what you're really talking about is a minority of a minority, right? So you have conservative folks. Those are people that you can perhaps have legitimate debate with or legitimate agreement or disagreement. And then you have the far right, with which there is really no way to have a productive conversation. And so, and then within that, you have even more extreme people. And it's those people who are seem to be making the difference, and they're pulling they have a very loud voice, and the people in that movement are very, very active socially and politically, meaning that they go vote, they exercise all of their rights, and they pull everybody else to the right in order, so a center right person moves further to the right so that he can stay, or he or she can stay in office, right? And so, I mean, that's what we're seeing in the United States. We see it to an extreme degree in the United States, but also in countries around the world, like Sweden, like Germany, obviously Hungary, Finland has had some stuff, Brazil. So it's all over the world, this sort of shift to the right. And I would bring it down to a lack of resources, a lack of consistent and sufficient resources for the ideas of protecting civil society. That's one of the biggest problems. Another is that these groups, they got together at the, during the time of the civil rights movement, and then especially when Roe was enacted, and they made a plan, and they have been working on that plan for 50 to 60 years and have never taken their eye off the ball. And they don't let things like money, you know, they're not having to beg for money. They're not worried about hurting anybody's feelings or staying within certain codes of conduct. They have a plan and they're going to execute it. And it's coming to fruition. And Project 2025 indicates to me that it is within, they believe it is within their grasp.
Now, can you talk a little bit about that sort of the question of a big tent in a democracy, where there's sort of a belief I think many people have that, you know, if Trump or a Republican wins the president and they enact some policies that are conservative, that is like within the bounds of normal democratic action because they won an election, and that there's nothing to worry about in terms of maintaining like civil society and the next democracy. Is that true within Project 2025, that as long as there's another election, it all can be undone?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't want to sound pessimistic about it, but we haven't recovered from the 2016 to 2020, and then the continued removal of rights in from 20 to 24. The idea that Americans can take for granted, as we always have, rightfully, that our institutions will hold, that our democracy is so solid that nothing can happen to it, I think that is a mistake. I do not want people to be afraid. I just want people to exercise their rights within our democratic process. And is it possible for a right-wing president to get into office and destroy a lot of our democratic foundation? I think the answer is yes. On the other hand, when you say implement conservative policies, you know, there's a difference between conservative and far right. Like, you have a policy disagreement versus eliminating something like, for example, I mean, this is the first thing that comes to my mind, is that, you know, stopping all funding to agencies in other countries if they provide contraceptive care. That doesn't mean abortions, but even contraceptive care. And, you know, is that conservative or is that far right? I mean, people would disagree. But is it conservative to you know, a tax policy, an economic policy? Those are the kinds of things that I would put in under the heading of conservative policy, potential disagreements, as opposed to far right things where you're taking a government and making it your own.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, right? Because all of these federal departments, they are under the executive branch. They are serving someone at the whim of the president. And yet we assume that, let's say, the Department of Agriculture is going to be neutral in how it approaches sort of fundamental questions of governance. And yeah, when there are these norms, it seems like it's hard to draw a line of this is within the bounds of political disagreement and democratic action, and this is something that an elected official shouldn't really mess with. How do you make that distinction?
In some cases, you're going to have to make it back on a case-by-case basis, right? Because there are some things that I, as a liberal progressive, are not going to agree with policy-wise, but I'm going to recognize that this is how our government functions and work within that. But what you have now, so the agencies are within the executive branch, and you have rulemaking within the agencies. So the agencies are allowed to make rules about how different policies are enacted or not enacted, which is meant to be a part of their independent status, right? And this project wants to eliminate that. They want, because their belief is that within the agencies also, people have been brainwashed. They're too woke. They're too married to a radical liberal agenda in order to make reasonable rules that are good for everybody. But primarily what it comes down to, in one case is that, like the EPA, Project 2025 would see it go away. They would see all regulation lifted from energy initiatives. They want to get rid of the endangered species list because it just interferes with business and energy efforts. And in order to do that, you have to get rid of the rulemaking within that agency, or get rid of the agency itself and put those and put that function somewhere else. So I would say that is another aspect of authoritarian behavior, meaning that you don't have a diverse approach to governing the nation.
All right, I thought maybe we could pivot a little bit, and I know that in recent comments, Trump has sort of triangulated a little bit on abortion and has tried to say that it is he's moderated his approach and leaving it to the states, I think, is something he said. And then Project 2025 has quite a bit to say about women's reproductive rights and would you say those are in tension or contradictory, or is there a way to thread that needle? Well, I guess
the thing is, this is my personal belief, not my organ, but the Trump really has no position on abortion or LGBTQ rights or any of these things that have become the focus of so many campaigns and so much legislation in this country, because we are, we're in a culture war at this point. We hardly talk about issues that really matter. And I don't personally think that Trump cares one way or the other. He wants to get reelected, and he sees that the abortion issue is a loser, right? And so he's trying to figure out, as you say, to thread that needle. But I can tell you that when he said, floated the idea, I think it was 15 or 16 weeks, and then he said, we're gonna let the states handle it, like the court said. All of these folks on the right, particularly the evangelical right, were very upset because it is their goal to eliminate all abortion, period. They want a federal ban. And it's sort of like he's breaking trust with them because they're giving him the support he needs, and he better give them what it is that they want. And so he, I believe, compromised by saying it's at the state level, meaning nothing, right? Meaning that he will, if he were to be elected and if the Congress was made up in such a way to allow it to happen, they would introduce a federal ban on abortion and he would approve it.
All right, we have a caller, Harry, who wants to talk about the local impact of Project 2025. Go ahead, Harry.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to have your guest speak about local and state efforts would be inspired by this Project 2025. And also, what would this Project 2025 say about unions and the rights of working people? There's been a recent upsurge And how would that be in union activity? How would that likely be affected if this right-wing group would come into power? Thanks very much for your time. I'll take my answer off the air. Bye.
Thank you for your question. I think that they are not pro-union, but they define themselves as pro-worker. Now, this is where you might have a policy disagreement. They want businesses to be able to make all the decisions that they need to make or want to make without government interference. And so anything that's going to mess with that, they are opposed to. At the same time, they also want 12-year-olds to be able to work with their parents' consent. So it's the extremes of workers' rights. If you understand, if I'm explaining it right. So with that and how that manifests locally is that you're going to have things like if they eliminated the Department of Education, then all of your schools would no longer have the regulations that come from the Department of Education, all the rulemaking, the laws that ensure that children get educations. It would also mean that if you had and I'm sorry, I cannot recall everything about Wisconsin right now. I did do a lot of research back a couple of years ago and during the 2020 election. But if, you know, if 2025 were being enacted, all the aspects of it, it means that any legislation that's introduced in a state, depending on the makeup of the legislature, you're more likely to get it through. Are you going to have changes like in Wisconsin to have the justices are elected and what they can do? You know, it's going to have, I'm so sorry to say this, but a trickle-down effect, you know, on all the states, not to mention that they are writing legislation for the states. And they're tailoring it to each state to try to get it passed. And it's, you know, it mirrors the efforts of the federal efforts of Project 2025.
Yeah, and if I could draw a couple parallels, there does seem to be an interesting politicization of nonpartisan governmental bodies in Wisconsin, especially around elections and trying to claim that there is sort of a wokeism aspect in the Wisconsin Election Commission and then trying to oust people for that, and that a neutral body is kind of viewed as suspect and it has to be politicized in order to make sure that it is quote unquote fair. And there's also, maybe this is a little bit of a pivot too, an interesting parallel between the questions of DEI in Wisconsin, it's about the university, but in Project 2025, I think DEI is a larger boogeyman. Can you talk a little bit about the role of DEI initiatives in how Project 2025 looks at the executive branch?
Sure. If I could just say something about your comment on how it is in Wisconsin. Of course, Wisconsin is not the other state, but it is more surprising because it's a bit, somewhat of a reversal of how things have been in the past. But the organizations behind 2025, Heritage, Alliance Defending Freedom, American Legal First, all of these groups, they do think that in certain states that things have been, like you say, too woke, too neutral, and it is suspect because what it needs to be is right. And by right, it means that everybody needs to follow their rules. And so it's not a matter of, I'm agreeing with what you're saying. If it's neutral, then it's not effective, or it's going to harm people because they're not making decisions based on these ideologies that are throughout Project 2025. And because what their goal is for us to have a country that is not in any way separated from its Christian foundation. So, I mean, we can get in more into that, but that's it's about a surety of their beliefs, and that in order to save this country, this is what has to happen. For DEI, they want to remove all references. There can be no DEI initiatives in any federal agency or anybody that receives federal money. They want to remove all references to the terms racial equity, affirmative action. They want to remove any term from all federal paperwork that refers to gender identity or LGBT, anything to do with LGBTQ world. And because, as I said earlier, they consider it to be a noxious idea that is actually racist, that DEI initiatives, which are meant to be informative and let people have an understanding of the different, you know, of their neighbors or their colleagues, if we're talking about a work environment, that everybody is different, and to be educated and have an acceptance of that. Well, they say that DEI initiatives promote reverse racism. So there's a lot of, we got to get rid of this anti-white racism, and that we're destroying the country by trying to bring racial equity initiatives into the workplace, and that all of this needs to be removed and potentially fire everybody in the federal government that was hired based on one of these protected classes within an affirmative action program. It's pretty extreme.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is A Public Affair on WORT. Today, our guest is Wendy Vaya. She is discussing the likely policies for the next Republican administration, as well as sort of the trickle-down policies and the approach to the federal government of sort of right-wing conservatism. If you have any questions about the authoritarianism in movement conservatism, please give us a call at 608-256-2001. Yeah, I think there's kind of an interesting, I don't know if it's a contradiction, but an interesting like manifestation of reality here, where the approach of Project 2025 is that these positions, the federal government is already political, and so they're not actually changing anything when they make it political. It already is, and they're just taking it back from the left and the left wing. I guess, is there any truth to that? And what does that mean?
Well, I don't think there's any truth to that. That's my personal belief. I mean, you're always going to have individual situations where things haven't gone exactly the way they're supposed to be. But writ large, no, I do not think that the government is too woke. It is filled with tens and tens of thousands of people who cannot possibly all agree on everything, right? And but that's their position and their justification for making these changes. But it's not just about that it's already politicized, so it's okay if they do it and put their ideas in there. It's about the fact that they are doing what is mandated to be done. And we can get into some of the Christian nationalist aspects of the plan now, but everything that they support, it's either very, very ruthlessly capitalistic or ruthlessly sort of solidifying the idea that Christianity, that the United States is a Christian country and should be run as such.
So yeah, so let's dig into that. What is Christian nationalism, and how does it fit into modern right-wing thought?
Well, I think that it is one of the drivers of far-right extremism in the political sphere in the United States. Also, just quickly, it's also a driver for, so you know, what we might consider to be hate groups. for Patriot Front, for Proud Boys, you know, they, the Klan, all of these groups have a, well, while it may not be as prominent now as it was, you know, decades ago, but there is a foundation of Christianity, meaning anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim, anti every other religion. And so the one thing I haven't mentioned is the connecting the dots and how we got to January 6th and that role, but we'll come back to that. Christian nationalism is the idea that the country should be run based on a biblical worldview. You may know that Mike Johnson, our current Speaker of the House, when asked what his worldview was, he was like, have you read the Bible? If you have, then you know my worldview. They tend to have extreme positions that being LGBTQ is a sin, that that abortion obviously is a sin, and there can be no exceptions there. But there's also things like women, there shouldn't be no-fault divorce because women shouldn't be able to ask for a divorce. That the nuclear family, the traditional family, should be at the core of everything that we do in our society. And by that, I mean a mom and a dad, a male, biological female, that are married to each other and produce children, and they should all, that's what a family looks like. And that's the only way that our country is going to succeed from this point forward. It's the idea that how the Bible is interpreted, or the interpretations of the Bible, or how we should make our laws. And that's what we're seeing with the Supreme Court now, and which was the plan. It was always the plan. And so, in other words, there is no breakdown between church and state. That is a fallacy in their view. The United States cannot be separated from its Christian foundation, period.
And would you say that's a sort of a continuation of Reaganite family values, Christianity, or is this something new? Like, what is the difference between then and now, or is there not much?
I mean, whatever was happening privately or, you know, behind the scenes, you would not have a blatant dismissal of the separation of church and state, right? This is one of those lines that have been crossed now, because America, you know, when everybody thinks about the United States, what are some of the things? Well, separation of church and state is one of the main things. And that's why we had the revolution and became a country and all of that. And whatever people have thought all these years, they have definitely thought there shouldn't be a separation. But did they say it? Did they put it in policy papers? And this is different.
And why is that an important line to cross? If we sort of suspect that there were at least some people in the movement that thought this all along, but now we have the Heritage Foundation putting out pretty explicit stuff. What does that difference mean?
Well, it means, I keep going back to these lines that have been crossed. So we've crossed that line, and it's going to be years before we can go back, because these ideas have been mainstreamed and normalized. And so it's going to be years before we can put them sort of back to the fringe where they belong. It means that there is a fundamental reordering, or there's a desire for a fundamental reordering of our government and our society. In the United States, people are free to worship as they wish, and they are not meant to be discriminated against or negatively influenced or have any kind of interference from another religion. They're able to practice their religion. And if you have a government that is fundamentally Christian, then what about all the millions and millions of people in the United States who are not Christian? What about the idea that there are even more millions of people who are Christian, but who have different ideas within Christianity. There's many, many people, most are going to say, no, we do not think that you should, keep trans people out of public view. It's so you have that spectrum within Christianity. And what they're pushing for is the strictest, most exclusionary, least accepting and forgiving aspect of the interpretation of Christianity.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but we do have a question from an online listener asking about if there's a way forward for the Democratic Party. Are they going to stick with Biden? And if they do, or even if they don't, I guess, how can we walk back some of these lines that have been crossed?
Well, I mean, I will say that there's two things that everyday people can do. And I know, and they seem very basic, but that is what's required here. State your opinion. I don't mean get in arguments with your neighbor, but I mean, when you disagree or agree with a potential, a policy initiative, say what you think about it. Don't normalize it. Don't just say, oh, that's just Trump, or that's just whoever your local representative is. Say, no, we're not going to do that. And the best way to do that, you say it publicly in your communities, in your houses of worship, wherever you might socialize, but you also exercise your vote. And I know that it seems basic, as I said, but that is the most important thing you can do, because as things are going with gerrymandering, which is a huge part of Project 2025, we do not want to reach a point where our vote doesn't matter.
And to build on the question a little bit too, is there anything you wish the Democratic Party were doing to combat this, the authoritarianism? Is there anything you could see them helping out with here?
Well, I would say this, not just about the Democratic Party, but about all folks, even those that are very politically aware. They don't know enough. Some people don't even know Project 2025 exists. Some of our members of Congress don't know that it exists. I've talked to many congressional staffs and they're like, what is that? So they're not, everybody is sort of focused on what it is they need to do to get reelected, as opposed to thinking about what they need to do to prevent the implementation of some of these initiatives of Project 2025, regardless of who is elected president.
All right. Well, we have just a little bit time left. Do you have any last thoughts, anything I didn't touch on that you'd like to about Project 2025 or the larger conservative movement?
I think that, well, first I want to thank you for having me on and for us having this discussion. It can seem a little pessimistic and maybe a little wonky, but it's so important because we're able to take these policy initiatives and apply them and apply them to real people's lives. How is it going to change your neighbor's life or your life? And just encourage folks in the media, like your team, that they provide the opportunity to talk about these issues as much as possible. Project 2025 is... it is the culmination of 50 years of work, and it is going to take a lot for us to push it back to the fringe. And so we all kind of need to be in on that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today. That was Wendy Vaya from the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Thanks to Jay Desari Ramos for producing the show. Thanks to Jay Davis for engineering the show. Thanks to our receptionist, Mary Jo. Thanks to Charlie Pittman. Have a good one, everyone.
recorded with information that would never be reported.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Northern Ukrainian city of Chernihiv was hit by deadly strikes on Wednesday morning, as Danny Eberhard reports.
The destruction in Chernihiv was another stark reminder of Ukraine's apparently increasing vulnerabilities. A group of European leaders meeting in NATO headquarters stressed they understood the urgency of Kyiv's appeals. Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance's members were working on bolstering Ukraine's air defences. He didn't specify what systems they might provide, but left open the possibility they could include more Patriot batteries. He also emphasized that member states should prioritize providing Ukraine with key military aid, even ahead of meeting commitments on their own NATO defense capabilities.